Great. Thank you very much, and thank you for coming. I know there are a lot of great talks happening this week here, so I appreciate you coming to this one. And thank you just for the invitation as well. It's a great honor to be here. So indeed, my talk is on 60S CFTs and group theory. It's based on a series of papers with collaborators Jonathan Heckman, Dave Morrison, Cameron Vaffa, Alessandro Tomasiello, as well as some work that's almost done with Napadol Mekaria. So my talk today is going to be split into three parts. And in each part, I'm sort of going to give the main punchline, and then I'm going to explain it in more detail. So first of all, I'm going to start out by talking about the classification of 60S CFTs, and we'll break this into two steps. First of all, we'll classify strings and the tensor branches of these theories. Next, we'll talk about the gauge algebras and particles associated with them. Secondly, and this will be the main point of my talk, I'll talk about the relationship between two particular classes of 60S CFTs and two particular classes of homomorphisms. And finally, I'll sort of speculate on the implications of this for 60S CFTs. I'll talk about C theorems in six dimensions, and I'll speculate about the possibility of classifying RG flows in six dimensions using this relationship to group theory. So to begin, you might ask, why should we study 60S CFTs in the first place? Nam tells us that 6 is the maximal number of dimensions in which a superconformal field theory can exist. And really, the most surprising fact about these theories is that they do indeed exist in the first place. That's because for a 60S CFT, the fundamental degrees of freedom are not actually particles, but rather they're strings in the limit of zero tension. So this seems sort of surprising. You'd imagine that when you have some strings, you should have some non-local theory. But it turns out that in the limit, as you take the tension of these strings to zero, you actually get an interacting local quantum field theory. This field theory arises as the world volume theory of M5 brains. So I think for this reason alone, it's interesting to study. But if you're more of a realist, and you're really, you know, just interested in theories in lower dimensions, things that can actually we might actually be able to produce in the lab, you can always consider the compactification of these theories down to 6, 5, 4, 3, or 2 dimensions. Of course, the pioneering work in studying the compactivications of 60 SCFTs down to 4 dimensions was done by Davide a number of years ago. Now, in that paper, the focus was on the compactification of theories with 2,0 supersymmetry in 6 dimensions. So these have 16 supercharges. We're going to be today more interested in theories with half that amount of supersymmetry, so 1,0 60S CFTs. And the compactification of these theories is are really much less understood. There's been some recent work from a number of people working in compactifications of these theories, but there's a lot of things to still understand. So for today, I'm going to focus, I'm going to stay in 6 dimensions, and we're going to focus on these 1,0 60S CFTs. These theories have a SO6,2 conformal symmetry, they have 8 supercharges, and they have an SU2 R symmetry. They've been studied by many groups since the 90s. These are just some of them. But even today, they're still viewed as very mysterious. One of the reasons is that, again, the fundamental degrees of freedom are not particles, but these tensionless strings. And furthermore, these theories do not emit Lagrangian descriptions. So it's sort of difficult to get a handle on them. One of the ways you could think about doing it is using the conformal bootstrap. And there's been some work in this regard for the 2,0 theories. But today, we're going to take a different approach and classify 60S CFTs on the tensor branch. So we're not actually getting into the nitty-gritty of what's happening at the superconformal fixed point. Rather, we're classifying these theories as we move away from the superconformal limit onto what's called the tensor branch. And an assumption of this classification is that all 60S CFTs do have such a tensor branch. That's an assumption that we're making. But once we've made this assumption, we can actually classify 60S CFTs using F theory. This classification is nearly entirely field theoretic, in the sense that nearly all F theory conditions can be phrased in field theory terms. And the result is that 60S CFTs all take the form of these generalized quivers that look like this. So in this quiver diagram, these blue circles correspond to gauge groups. And they're joined together by these black lines, which indicate bifundamental hypermultiplets and generalizations of bifundamental hypermultiplets that are called conformal matter. And I'll discuss this more in detail later. You note that these quivers are all very simple. There's sort of some decoration that you're allowed to do on the far left and on the far right. But in the interior, things are uniquely fixed by anomaly cancellation. And note also that these quivers all take this nice linear tree-like form. There are no loops. The classification looks like chemistry in the sense that we begin with these atoms, which are the so-called non-Higgsable clusters of Morrison and Taylor in F-theory language. And we sort of stitch these things together to form more complicated radicals and molecules, which are themselves the 60 SCFTs. So this is the main punchline of this classification. Now I'm going to describe how it's carried out in more detail. And to begin, I'm going to start off with the example of the 2,060 SCFTs. These theories admit an ADE classification. So if you give me some simply laced Lie algebra, type A, D, or E, I can give you a 62,0 theory. We can construct these actually in the weakly coupled limit of F theory, which is type 2b string theory. And we do this by compactifying type 2b on an orbifold of type C2 mod gamma ADE. So this gamma ADE represents a discrete subgroup of SU2. And according to the McKay correspondence, these things are also in one-to-one correspondence with ADE Lie algebras. So as you might imagine, if you compactify type 2b on an orbifold of type A, you get an A-type 2,0 theory. D, you get a D-type 2,0 theory. And E, you get an E-type 2,0 theory. Now, these orbifolds, of course, are singular. But we can resolve this singularity to get a smooth space. And when we do this, we replace the singular point with what's called a bouquet of two spheres. And the bouquet of two spheres intersects according to the A, D, and E type Dinkin diagrams, depending on the type of the singularity. So here, when you see these pictures, you should think of this circle as corresponding to a curve of self-intersection minus 2. And this curve, this two-sphere, intersects its neighbors at these points of intersection. So this curve here intersects this curve at one point, this curve intersects this one at one point, and so on and so forth. In order to get from this model where you have this resolved geometry back to the superconformal limit, you need to shrink all of these curves simultaneously. So as you shrink all the curves to zero size, you get back to this orbifold point. And that's where the superconformal fixed point occurs. OK, so that was the 2,0 theories. Now we want to move on and study the 1,0 theories. We're going to construct these not in type 2b string theory, but in its strongly coupled cousin, which is F theory. And as far as we know, all 60 SCFTs have an F theory avatar. Now, there's an asterisk here, because there are a couple of 60 SCFTs that we know about for which the F theory construction is not quite known yet. This is something I know that Lakshaw is actually working on right now with a couple of collaborators. So hopefully soon, I'll be able to remove this asterisk. But there's sort of a couple subtleties here at the moment. OK, so before I tell you how this works, I need to tell you what F theory is. And the good news is that if you're sort of new to F theory, if you aren't an expert, sort of just about every paper on F theory in the last 15 years has sort of the same five-page introduction to the subject where they tell you how F theory works. So if you're new, you can sort of just go to archive, type in F theory, find some paper, any paper you want, and read the first five pages. And you'll have a pretty good idea of how it works. But for the purposes of my talk, we really just need the very basics. And so the basic idea is that F theory is the strongly coupled limit of type 2b string theory. And we're going to geometrize type 2b string theory in the following sense. In type 2b, we have this axial dilaton tau, which tells us about the string coupling. And we can take this tau to vary over space-time. In F theory, what we're going to do is we're going to take this tau, this field tau, to describe the complex structure of a torus, which is fibered over space-time. So at any point in space-time, we have some elliptic fiber, some torus fiber, and the complex structure of the fiber at that point tells us what this tau is. So in this sense, you can think of F-theory as sort of a 12-dimensional theory. There are the 10 dimensions of space-time, and then there are these 2 dimensions of the elliptic fiber. And these 2 dimensions are on a different footing. Gravitons do not propagate in these dimensions, but it's still sort of a good intuitive picture to think of F-theory as being this 12-dimensional theory. In our case, we want to use F-theory to construct 6-dimensional SCFTs. Now, 12 minus 6 is 6, so therefore, we want to study the compactifications of F-theory on 6-dimensional manifolds. In order to preserve supersymmetry, we need this manifold to be Calabi-Yau, so we want to talk about Calabi-Yau threefolds. We want it to be non-compact, because we want to decouple gravity. And finally, we need it to have this elliptic fibration. So we need a T2 that's fibered over some complex 2-dimensional base. And so the classification of 6D SCFTs therefore corresponds to the classification of these elliptically fibered non-compact Calabi-Yau threefolds. The classification proceeds in 2 steps. First of all, we're going to classify the singularities in the base. And these are going to tell us about the spectrum of strings in the 6D SCFTs. The reason for this is that I get a string in 6 dimensions from wrapping a D3 brain around a 2-cycle P1 in the base. And as I shrink all of these curves down to zero size, this huge collection of intersecting curves down to zero size, that's going to give me a singularity in the base. And this is what we saw for the 2, 0 theories. Right? We had this bouquet of 2 spheres, and in order to get to the superconformal limit, we had to shrink all of them down to a point. So the same thing is going to happen here. We're going to get a singular point, and the classification of these bases corresponds to the classification of those singularities. We also, the second step then, is to classify the singularities in the fiber. Over a generic point in this base, B2, there's just going to be some smooth fiber, some smooth torus that lives over that point. But at certain loci in the base, in particular over these curves that you see here, what can happen is that the torus fiber can degenerate. So instead of having a smooth elliptic fiber, I get some singularity of the fiber. And these singular fibers correspond to the positions of 7 brains in type 2B language. And in gauge theory, these singular fibers give rise to non-abelian gauge algebras. So this means if I understand how the fiber degenerates, if I understand the singularities in the fiber, this will tell me about the spectrum of gauge algebras in the 6D SCFT, and correspondingly the spectrum of particles. Okay, so first of all, we want to classify the bases and the tensionless strings that we get in these 6D SCFTs. And the reason that we get these tensionless strings, the way that you realize them in F theory, is that they come from D3 brains wrapping, collapsing 2 spheres. The tension of the string in 6 dimensions, when you take a D3 to wrap one of these CP1s, is proportional to the volume of the CP1. So shrinking this curve down to zero size to reach the superconformal limit corresponds to taking the tension of the string to zero. And this is, as I said at the beginning, this is sort of the hallmark of a 6D SCFT, are these tensionless strings. So generically, what we need to do is some collection of these 2 spheres intersecting according to some pattern. And in order to get a 6D SCFT, we need to simultaneously contract all of the curves. And this actually gives us a very non-trivial constraint on the allowed bases, B2, that can give rise to a 6D SCFT. Because if you give me some collection of curves intersecting according to some pattern, generically, I won't be able to simultaneously contract all of those curves. So I won't get an interacting SCFT in the IR. So in particular, the requirement that I can simultaneously take all of the curves to zero size is what rules out any loops in my 6D quivers. And the result is that I get quivers that all look like this. As we saw at the very beginning, we have this linear quiver, tree-like form. And here, in the F-theory language, you can think of these nodes is corresponding to curves in the base. Shrinking them down to zero size gives me the 60 SCFT. There's one last thing we need to talk about in discussing the strings of these theories, which is the charge of these strings. So when I wrap a D3 brain around some 2-sphere in my base, I get a string which is charged in 6 dimensions. And the charge of the string is related geometrically to the self-intersection number of the curve that it wraps. Now this self-intersection number, I've called the negative of the self-intersection number here n. And this n must be a positive integer. If I try to take n to be 0 or negative, I'll get a curve that is not contractible. And so I won't be able to get a 60 SCFT out of it. For curves of self-intersection minus 1 or minus 2, the fiber that lives above this curve will generically be smooth. But as I take the self-intersection of my curve to be more and more negative, I find that the fiber automatically becomes singular. And the more negative I take the curve, the larger, the bigger the singularity. Correspondingly, curves of more negative self-intersection have larger gauge algebras. So here's the list. Again, if I have a curve of self-intersection minus 1 or minus 2, I can have a smooth fiber, which corresponds to no gauge algebra. But when I have a curve of self-intersection minus 3, the fiber is necessarily singular, and the minimal gauge algebra that I have living on this curve is an SU3. And you can see as we go down and down the list, the minimal gauge algebra becomes larger and larger. And the last one we can have here is minus 12, which gives us an E8 gauge algebra. If you try to have a curve of self-intersection minus 13 or below, what you find is that the singularity becomes too large to be described in F-theory. In other words, there's no gauge algebra that could possibly correspond to a singularity of this type. And this means in F-theory language, it means that these models cannot be described in F-theory language. And so these are just bad models, and we throw them out. So this describes the minimal fiber enhancements of these above any given curve. But we can actually enhance them further. So minimally, I get an SU3 living on a minus 3 curve. But I can enhance the singularity type of the fiber, which increases the size of the gauge algebra. And so you see now I can get an SO7, and I can enhance that to get an SO8, and so on and so forth. Similarly, for a minus 4 curve, I minimally have an SO8, but I can enhance that up to an E6, and then I can enhance it up to an E7. Going up, the chain here corresponds to the process of unhigsing. So if I start with this E7, I can Higgs this down to E6 by giving a valve to some fundamental, and I can Higgs this down to SO8. A crucial fact about 60 SCFTs, which enables their classification, is that anomaly cancellation imposes extremely strong constraints on the allowed spectrum of matter for any given 60 SCFT. So in particular, if I take a curve of self-intersection minus 3 and I give it some SU3 gauge algebra, I'm not allowed to have any matter which is charged under this SU3. Any matter I try to throw in that's going to be charged under that thing is going to violate anomaly cancellation. Similarly, for an SO7, I need to have exactly 2 spinners of SO7. Any other combination of matter won't work. And so this actually works to uniquely fix the allowed the charged matter in such theories, with one exception that I know of, which is for a minus 1 curve with SU6 gauge algebra, you get 2 choices of the matter that you can possibly have. But in any other case, there's only 1 choice. The matter is fixed uniquely for a 60 SCFT. And so this more or less completes the classification of 60 SCFTs. Of course, there is sort of the actual process of writing it all out. And this takes, I guess it took us 125 pages or something. But the process is there. It's just a matter of going down and systematically doing it. And the result is that you get 60 SCFTs that look like this. So this is how I will draw 60 SCFTs for the rest of the talk. These are just generic examples of what you get. You see that they're labeled here by this collection of curves in the base, which are intersecting at neighboring points. And they're labeled by the self-intersection number of the curve, so minus 4, minus 1, minus 4, and so on and so forth. And as we saw, when you have a curve of self-intersection of minus 3 or below, you automatically get a gauge algebra that's associated with that curve. And so here we have an SO8 gauge algebra, more SO8s, an E6, SU3, and so on and so forth. Here, and frequently, I will not draw the charged matter in these theories. So there's a there's a mixed representation here of the fundamental of SU2 and the spinner of SO7 that lives at each of these intersection points. But it's sort of not essential to depict that information because, once again, the allowed matter is uniquely fixed by anomaly cancellation. So if I just tell you what the string charges are here, if I tell you what the self-intersection of these curves are, and I tell you also what the gauge algebras are, you can uniquely work out what the matter is. OK, so this completes the first punchline of my talk, the first third of it, which is the classification of 60 SCFTs. Before I move on to talking about 60 SCFTs and homomorphisms, let me pause and see if there are any questions.
Is there any subtlety in what's the global symmetry of each of these
things? Yeah, there is a subtlety, actually. It's sort of hard to read off in some cases. But we're going to see later that actually, remarkably, using this link with homomorphisms, we can actually do it. So that's actually one of the nice things in my talk coming up. Good. OK. So if there are no further questions, let me get on to the meat of my presentation. And here's the main point, that two large classes of 60 SCFTs have connections to structures in group theory. In particular, they're in one-to-one correspondence with these two classes of homomorphisms, homomorphisms from SU2 into some Lie algebra of type ADE, and homomorphisms from some discrete subgroup of SU2 into E8. So what are these theories? The first one over here on the left, this class of theories consists of a collection of minus 2 curves with some ADE gauge algebra G. And here, and henceforth, I'm going to use square boxes to indicate the global symmetry. So here we have, on the right, we have a global symmetry, G, which is the same as this gauge symmetry. On the left, I've written a more generic G sub left. And the different choices of G sub left correspond to the different homomorphisms here. So for instance, if I take G left equal to G, this corresponds to simply the trivial homomorphism. But as I consider a more and more complicated homomorphism down here, this corresponds to breaking G down to some G left, which is a subalgebra of G. So the different choices for this G left correspond to these different homomorphisms. And the same thing here. Generically, G sub left will be equal to E8, and that's for the trivial homomorphism. But if I turn on some more complicated homomorphism, that E8 will be broken down to a subalgebra.
Is it just like the centralizer of the homomorphism?
Correct, right. And yeah, I'll go through in more detail how exactly this works. But this is sort of the big picture. Good, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to explain, first of all, why you would predict such things to arise, how you predict these correspondences. And then I'll show you that these correspondences actually work explicitly by constructing the corresponding 60 SCFTs. OK, so we're going to begin by constructing we're going to start by doing this one over here on the left. And the original theories, that is the undeformed theories corresponding to the trivial homomorphism, actually have a construction in M theory. And they're realized by M5 brains probing a C2 mod gamma ADE, or Baffold singularity. So here we have some number n of M5 brains. In the F theory description, this corresponds to the number of minus 2 curves. And then the Orbifold singularity of type ADE tells us what this collection of gauge algebras is. So this G is some ADE, so Lie algebra corresponding to this ADE. So this description over here, what we've seen so far, is essentially what's what you could call the partial tensor Rance description. In the case of, in the A-type case, this is actually the full tensor branch description. And what you have at these points of intersection is you have some bifundamental hypermultiplets stretching between this SUK and this SUK. However, things are a little bit more complicated in the D and E-type cases. Here, you want to say that there's some bifundamental hypermultiplet of SO2K and SO2K living at that point of intersection. But that doesn't really make sense to talk about. If you try to write down such a bifundamental hypermultiplet, you'll quickly find that it violates anomaly cancellation conditions. So what you have, another way to say this, in F-theory language, is that the fiber becomes too singular here at this point of intersection to be described in F-theory. It's very similar to what happens if you try to take a curve of self-intersection 13 or below. And so as a result, what you have to do is that you have to resolve the singularity. You blow up this point of intersection, and that gives you a curve of self-intersection minus 1, which will actually carry an SP gauge algebra. And so as a result, this quiver here becomes an alternating chain of SP, SO, SP, SO gauge groups, which you might well have seen in other contexts in string theory. And similarly, for the E6 case, we have to resolve these points of intersection several times, and we get these 1-3-1 chains here with these SU3s. This is what's known as conformal matter, what I briefly mentioned earlier. And you should think of it as a generalization of a bifundamental hypermultiplet. So here we had a bifundamental. Here the analog of a bifundamental is this minus 1 curve with this SP gauge algebra and some half bifundamentals stretched here and here. And here, the generalization of the bifundamental is this whole collection of these curves with the associated gauge algebras. So this is how you construct the undeformed theories. Now we want to deform these theories by introducing some nilpotent deformations. So we have a matrix phi, which in F theory characterizes the positions of 7 brains. So the eigenvalues of this field phi tell us about the positions of our 7 brains. If all the eigenvalues are different, it means that these brains are separated. If all the eigenvalues of phi are the same, it means that they're coincident. We have a stack of 7 brains. We're going to view the intersection points of neighboring CP1s, these points of intersection right here, as being marked points, at which we're going to allow phi to have some singular behavior. This gives us a Hitchin system, which is coupled to these defects at these marked points. It's described by these equations. And the key feature here for us are these moment maps, this triplet of moment maps, mu c and mu sub r. So this is a real moment map. This is a complex moment map. And we can split this mu c into two parts, a semi-simple part, which is more or less trivial, and a nilpotent part. And because this guy is more or less trivial, we're going to ignore it for today and focus simply on this nilpotent part. When we shut off mu s, we find that the moment maps give an SU2 algebra. So here, the role of the raising operator is played by mu c. The role of the lowering operator is played by its dagger. And the Cartan generator is played by mu r. So this means that because we have this SU2 algebra, the whole set of moment maps is characterized uniquely by mu c. Because if you give me mu c, or correspondingly j plus, I get j minus by simply taking its dagger, and I get j3 by simply taking their commutator. This choice of mu c also dictates the behavior of phi. So in other words, the choice of this nilpotent element, this nilpotent orbit mu c, tells me what the allowed deformation is of my theory. It tells me the different ways that I can separate these 7 brains and Higgs my theory. So these choices of mu c are labeled by homomorphisms from SU2 into G, because this mu c is an element of G. And you can see that we need mu c to be nilpotent. We need it to correspond to this raising operator J plus. And hence, for any choice of mu c, we get such a homomorphism. Another way to say this is that the choices of this mu c are classified by nilpotent orbits of this gauge algebra G. So the upshot of all this is simply that we expect for each deformation of phi, for each deformation of our 6D SCFT, we should get a unique homomorphism from SU2 into G, or equivalently, a unique nilpotent orbit of G. And we find that this actually is borne out explicitly. So we can actually construct these 6D SCFTs explicitly and show that this match works out. So here's an example. This is for the case of a Z4 M5 brains probing a Z4 singularity. So this is the choice of where we have an SU4. We have a series of SU4 gauge algebras. And we're going to consider then the homomorphisms from SU2 into SU4. Now these homomorphisms, and just generically, any homomorphisms, any set of homomorphisms from SU2 into SUK are characterized by partitions of K. So here there are 5 partitions of 4. There's 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, 2 plus 1 plus 1, 2 plus 2, 3 plus 1, and 4. And correspondingly, you see that indeed we have 1 6D SCFT for each of them. So starting here, this is the trivial homomorphism, and we get the theory of M5 brains probing Z4. We can now Higgs this SU4 down to an SU3. That gives us this quiver. We can Higgs it once again to SU2. And if we keep Higgsing, we move further and further down and get this full set of partitions. So it's easy to see that this works out for SUK. And in fact, you can also give a type 2A construction for these theories. So here we have some brain web diagrams. These black circles indicate NS5 brains. And these horizontal lines indicate D6s, which are stretched between the NS5s. So whenever I have, say, 4 D6s, this corresponds to an SU4 gauge algebra. And I can introduce these D8 brains, indicated by vertical lines. And these give what's called a Roman's mass. And they'll shrink the number of D6s on one side of the NS5. So here I have this, I add in this D8, and it shrinks the gauge algebra down from SU4 down to SU3. And moving down the hierarchy, I shift these D8s further and further to the right, and correspondingly Higgs the gauge groups down further and further. Now the reason why I should...
Why can't they have 3 D8s on the second from the left?
So these, I've sort of drawn this wrong. This here should correspond to the gauge algebras. So this should correspond to an SU3 gauge algebra. That we saw here. So if you're asking why, you're saying why can't you have, say, an SU3, 2 SU3s?
No, I'm asking if you can put 3 D8 brains.
Oh, 3 D8s?
Yes.
Not for the SU4 quivers. In field theory language, this would violate anomaly cancellation. So you can't have such a steep drop-off in gauge group rank here. For, say, SU5 or SU6, then you could do that. But here, this is sort of the full set. So the reason I bring up these diagrams is that, for those of you who are familiar, this might look very similar to the web diagrams that were studied by Davide and Ed Witten a few years ago. And there, they were constructing theories in 3 dimensions. With similar looking brain diagrams. Indeed, there's a simple way to get from these diagrams to the diagrams they considered, which is simply compactifying on T3 and performing T-dualities along each circle of the T3. When you do that, you get exactly the systems they considered. And thus, it's sort of not surprising that we see nilpotent orbits showing up once again here, just as they had in that work. OK, so this is the match. There's one other extremely nice feature about this correspondence, which is that there's also a match, not only from the theories and the nilpotent orbits, there's also a match between the RG flows of the theory and the ordering on nilpotent orbits. So given any 2 nilpotent orbits of some Lie algebra G, here, which I'll call O sub mu and O sub nu, you can define an ordering on these things where you say that O sub mu is greater than O sub nu if the closure of O sub mu contains O sub nu. In the case of SU gauge groups and SO gauge groups, these nilpotent orbits can be labeled by partitions. And so you say that one orbit is greater than another if the corresponding partition is greater than the partition of the latter. And here we say that one partition is greater than another if all of the partial row sums of the first are greater than or equal to all of the partial row sums of the second. So here, for our favorite SU4 example, you can define this ordering as follows. Here, the first partial row sum is 4, and as are all of the higher partial row sums, because there's 4 boxes in this row, and then there's 4 in the sum of these two rows, and so on. Here, the first partial row sum is 3, and the second partial row sum is 3 plus 1, which is 4, which means that all of the partial row sums from this guy are greater than or equal to the partial row sums from this one. Therefore, this one is greater than this, and so on down the line. This is greater than this, greater than this, and greater than this. So in this special case of SU4, this partial ordering is actually a total ordering, and any two partitions are related by this order. But for larger gauge groups, for SU5 and above, and for SO type and E type gauge groups, the ordering will actually be a partial ordering. And you can check that this ordering precisely matches the RG hierarchy that you have for the 60 SCFTs. So this partition is greater than this one. Correspondingly, this theory can flow to this one. This partition is greater than this one, so this one flows to this one, and so on and so forth. So I've shown you this example for SU4. It's very easy to see that this will work out for all the SU gauge groups. But as many of you know who have been working on string theory for a while, things often come in ADE classifications. And usually the A-type case is very easy and someone else has already done it. And the D-type case is hard and the E-type case is impossible. But in this case, actually, we can do all of the above. So we can do the D and E-type cases as well. So here's an example, SO8. These are all the theories here on the right. And on the left, there's the corresponding partitions, which label the nilpotent orbits. And then this big diagram is both the nilpotent hierarchy as well as the RG hierarchy between these theories. And here it is for E6, so getting even more complicated. And you can actually work it out for E7 and E8 as well. There's a perfect match, but I'm not going to show it because it's very big and you wouldn't be able to read it. So we found this match perfectly. And now you might want to sort of take this and see what can we learn about this? How can we use this match to learn about 60 SCFTs using what we know about nilpotent orbits? And one of the first things that we learn, something that's very exciting to me, as I mentioned, is that you can actually learn about the global symmetries of 60 SCFTs using this match. So how does this work? Well, you take some nilpotent orbit of some ADE Lie algebra G. You let f of mu be the subgroup of G that commutes with this nilpotent element. So for instance, for the trivial nilpotent orbit, this f of mu is just the entire group G. But as we have a more and more complicated nilpotent element, as we go down the RG hierarchy, the flavor symmetry will generically get smaller and smaller. And the claim is that this flavor symmetry of the orbit is precisely the global symmetry of the 60 SCFT associated with mu. Now, in some sense, this claim has to be true, because really, it was under this assumption that we were really able to perform this matching that you saw here in the first place. Because in most cases, it's pretty easy to look at a 60 SCFT and tell what the global symmetry is going to be. And from there, you can match it with the flavor symmetries, which are known already for all the nilpotent orbits. And so you can actually work out this whole picture by assuming that the global symmetry should be the same. But the reason why this is exciting is that there are actually a couple of cases. There are a few cases in 60 SCFTs where it's actually quite non-trivial to read off the global symmetry. And that's because the global symmetry you'd naively read off from field theory on the tensor branch and the global symmetry that F theory tells you that you expect are different. So I have two examples of this. these two theories here. Both of these theories show up in the E6 nilpotent hierarchy. So they show up. They show up right here and right here, respectively. And you can see from performing this match with nilpotent orbits that the global symmetries should be SU2 and SO7, respectively. Now, for this first one, this SU2 is pretty much what you would have expected from field theory. That's because in field theory, this minus 4 curve with the E6 has two fundamentals of E6. And so you'd imagine that these two fundamentals should transform under this SU2 and give you this SU2 flavor symmetry. However, if you try to compute this global symmetry from F theory, you find that you actually expect there to be no global symmetry at all. This was worked out, for instance, by Dave Morrison and a couple of his grad students. They found that any flavor symmetry you try to put in F theory, any non-compact flavor curve, will not be able to intersect this E6. So in F theory, the answer you get is trivial. In field theory, the answer you guess is SU2. And we learn here that field theory is getting the answer right, and F theory is getting the answer wrong. On the other hand, for this theory, F theory tells you that the answer should be SO7. So F theory gets the answer right. But in field theory, you would think that you should actually get an SO8, because you have four fundamentals of this SU2, which means you have eight half hypermultiplets. This is a pseudo-real representation, and so you expect to get an SO8 that transforms them as an 8. So what this means is that although on the tensor branch you have an SO8 global symmetry, when you go to the superconformal fixed point, you actually only get an SO7. So here, field theory is misleading, and F theory is giving you the right answer. And in fact, there's a more sophisticated field theory analysis that you can make, as was performed by Yuji Tachikawa, which shows that indeed this SO7 really is the right answer. But if you try to do this naive field theory argument, you would have gotten the wrong answer.
So field theory always overcome?
Sorry, say that again?
So field theory always gives you a bigger one?
So field theory always gives you a bigger answer than F theory. But the point is that sometimes field theory is right and sometimes F theory is right, as far as getting the global symmetry right.
My point was that sometimes field theory is less and then it's enhanced by some funny new current you construct. But
right.
Here it's always reduced from the naive.
Yes, that's right. So the point is that sometimes F theory is right, sometimes field theory is right. Before we had this match, it wasn't always clear what you should expect the global symmetries to be. But now we have this match with the nilpotent orbits. And the really nice thing about this is that the nilpotent hierarchies, especially the E8 nilpotent hierarchy, is sufficiently large, it's sufficiently diverse. You can sort of use it as a Rosetta Stone. So if you give me any 60 SCFT, I can take it, I can go find a 60 SCFT that looks similar in the E8 nilpotent hierarchy, and I can use that to tell you what the global symmetry is. So this might not be the most exciting thing for you, but for me, I spent many months sort of banging my head against a wall trying to figure out global symmetries of some of these 60 SCFTs, and so now we're sort of getting the answer for free, coming from group theory. Okay, so that was the first set of 60 SCFTs and homomorphisms. The second set I'll go through much more quickly. These 60 SCFTs also admit a construction in M theory. Now we're going to take M5 brains to probe this C2 mod gamma singularity once again. We're also going to take them to probe a Harava-Witten wall. So we have this E8 wall, we have these N M5 brains probing this wall, and also probing this singularity. It turns out that the number of 5 brains and the type of singularity are not sufficient to totally characterize the data of these 60 SCFTs. You can also turn on some boundary data at infinity, which is characterized by a flat E8 connection living at the boundary of this C2 mod gamma ADE, which is an S3 mod gamma. If you take just a trivial connection, this corresponds to this theory here, where we have an E8 global symmetry on the left corresponding to the E8 wall. But if I turn on non-trivial boundary data, just as we saw in the previous story, the global symmetry will be broken to some subgroup. And the different choices of global symmetry correspond to the different homomorphisms, or the different choice of boundary data. Now, these choices of boundary data, these flat E8 connections, are also in one-to-one correspondence with homomorphisms from gamma ADE into E8. So the upshot of all this is that we expect a one-to-one correspondence between homomorphisms from gamma ADE into E8 and these and deformations of these quivers. And once again, you can see that this works out. So here I've drawn the case of an A2 singularity, gamma A2, which is Z3. So we're looking at homomorphisms from Z3 into E8. And there's a nice trick that you can do with Dynkin diagrams to work out these homomorphisms that essentially deals or reduces to just deleting some nodes of the affine Dynkin diagram. So I start with the affine E8 Dynkin diagram. If I delete the first node, I get an E8 Dynkin diagram, and this gives me this E8 global symmetry. If I delete the first two nodes, this gives me this E7, hence the E7 global symmetry, and so on and so forth. As I delete different combinations of nodes, I get the full list of homomorphisms from Z3 into E8, and I get the full list of 60 SCFTs of this type. Okay, so that's how these two matches work out. And let me tell you this again, since it is the main takeaway from the talk. We see that these two large classes of 60 SCFTs are in one-to-one correspondence with these two classes of homomorphisms from these groups into E8. Okay, so now we can talk about what are the implications of this for the study of 60 SCFTs. And I'm sort of going to divide this last part into a past, present, and future. First of all, some work that Jonathan Heckman and I did about a year and a half ago is that we found significant evidence for the A theorem in six dimensions, as well as an infinite collection of other C theorems using this classification of 60 SCFTs. Some work that's ongoing right now that I'll talk about is that this actually relates to group theory in the sense that we can use our relationship, the relationships we just saw, to relate anomalies to group theory data. And this allows us to actually prove the A theorem for a particular class of our G flows between these theories. And then finally, sort of a future speculation is I'll speculate that we might actually be able to fully classify our G flows in six dimensions using these relationships to group theory. Okay, so first of all, anomalies in six dimensions. In a very nice paper in 2014, Yuji Tachikawa and friends taught people how to compute the anomaly polynomial for any 60 SCFT. So this is a polynomial in the characteristic classes. Here, this R represents the R symmetry bundle, and this T represents the tangent bundle. So these guys showed for any 60 SCFT how to compute these quantities alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. Now, we're interested in this quantity A here, which shows up in the relationship between the trace anomaly in six dimensions and this Euler density. And the statement of the A theorem, or in six dimensions, the A conjecture, is that A should decrease under our G flows. So this is a theorem in two and four dimensions, but in six dimensions, it's still unproven. A major step towards proving this was came from Clay Cordova, Thomas Dumitrescu, and Ken Introligator last year, which they showed how this A can in turn be related to these quantities alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. So when you combine these two works, you can calculate A for any 60 SCFT. We're not interested only in A, but more generally in candidate linear functionals of these coefficients alpha, beta, and gamma, and delta, which might decrease under flows. So here we define this linear functional C by taking some four vector and dotting it into this alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. And we want to look for C's that decrease under all our G flows. There are two types of flows to consider. There are the Higgs branch flows, which in F theory language are complex structure deformations, where you take some gauge algebra and you Higgs it down. There are also tensor branch flows, which in F theory language correspond to taking some curve in the base and expanding it to infinite size. So this takes a gauge symmetry and replaces it with a global symmetry. Now, there's sort of lots of smart people out there who will likely think of lots of clever ways that you might go about trying to prove the A theorem or these other C theorems for 60 SCFTs. In fact, in that paper by Cordova, Dumitrescu, and Intrilogator, they actually proved that the A theorem is necessarily satisfied for these tensor branch flows. But sort of Jonathan and I took sort of a different approach. In the words of computer scientist Ken Thompson, when in doubt, use brute force. So we have this huge class of 60 SCFTs. We understand the RG flows between them pretty well. So we can just actually go out and look and see if the A theorem is satisfied in some huge class of RG flows. And what we found is that not only does the A theorem appear to be satisfied, but in fact, there's an infinite class of other C theorems which appear to be satisfied as well. So here I've sort of drawn a region in parameter space. And this shaded region are all the parameter choices, all the choices of linear functionals that do decrease under RG flows. And you can see here this red dot indicates the parameter choice corresponding to the quantity A. So the fact that this red dot is within this shaded region tells you that A is indeed decreasing under RG flows. But you can see that there's nothing really special about this point. There's a huge class of things that decrease under RG flows. And this is in contrast with, say, the story in four dimensions. There, if you want to look for something that decreases under RG flows, A is sort of the only thing that you have to use. But here, any of these things will work just as well. Now, you might wonder, you know, this is a brute force approach. How can we really trust it? Perhaps we just missed some of the flows that will actually give tight constraints. But a major result of our analysis is that not only does A decrease, and not only do all these things decrease, but in fact, the tightest constraints on this monotonic region, the shaded region of parameter space, come from the very simplest flows. So here, this is sort of the simplest Higgs branch flow you can consider. These are some of the simplest tensor branch flows. And you can see that all of these more complicated flows are giving you strictly weaker bounds. So this gives us very good reason to think that actually this region is the right one, that this is robust, and that we probably shouldn't expect to find any really stronger constraints. In fact, for tensor branch flows, something you'll quickly notice when you do the sweep is that you're getting a parabola here, and anything above this parabola decreases under flows. And in fact, you can prove this analytically, quite simply. OK, so this is sort of the work that we have done. Sort of
What were the M2 and M3 coefficients?
OK, so remember we have this 4 vector? So we have M1, M2, M3, M4. And we want to dot this into this 4 vector of Tuft anomalies, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. Now, under both tensor branch flows and Higgs branch flows, delta is conserved, which means that M4 just doesn't show up at all. And you can just normalize M1 by setting it equal to 1. And then you essentially only have two choices of parameters, M2 and M3. And that's why we can reduce this parameter space to just this two-dimensional slice. Good. OK, so some work that's ongoing now, what we're finding is that in the particular class of theories that are related to nilpotent orbits, which we discussed in detail, you can actually relate the anomaly coefficients to group theory data. So you can express these alpha, beta, gamma, and delta in terms of quantity, in terms of group theoretic quantities associated with the nilpotent orbit. And this actually allows you to prove the A theorem explicitly for this particular class of flows corresponding to these nilpotent hierarchies. You can also relate delta. Delta is actually related in a very simple way, although I haven't drawn it. Delta is related in a very simple way to the nilpotent orbit, which is that delta is just proportional to the dimension of the orbit. So if you have a flow between two theories of corresponding to different nilpotent orbits, the difference in the dimension of those orbits tells you precisely what delta is. So delta counts this change in the size of the nilpotent orbit. OK, so let me conclude here. First of all, to summarize, we've seen that 60 SCFTs can be classified using F-theory. We found that there are these remarkable relationships between 60 SCFTs and these two classes of homomorphisms, which I discussed in detail. And we've also seen that there is strong evidence for a large class of C theorems, and in particular the A theorem in six dimensions. So now I'll end with sort of some speculations. It seems so far that we have sort of these special classes of 60 SCFTs where we can actually classify these RG flows because they're in correspondence with these nilpotent hierarchies. So we've related RG flows to group theory. However, it seems actually that it seems to me that these classes that we've considered are not actually so small, but in some sense they might actually even comprise the entire set of 60 SCFTs and the flows between them. The difficulty in making this statement, in being able to make this statement, is that things get confusing when you start having quivers that aren't very long. Because if you have a very long quiver, you can turn on some deformation on the far left and some deformation on the far right, and they don't talk to each other. But if you start taking quivers that are very short, sort of the breaking, these deformations on the left of the quiver and the deformations on the right of the quiver start talking to each other, and things get more complicated. But there might be a sense in which we can sort of classify all 60 SCFTs in terms of group theory data, and we might even be able to classify their RG flows in terms of this, in terms of these, this relationship with group theory. Once we've done this, we might actually also be able to prove the A theorem for such flows using properties from group theory. Although one might also argue that sort of once we have a full classification of 60 RG flows between 60 SCFTs, the A theorem might not actually be so interesting in that we now know sort of the full set, and we don't need to look for criteria for establishing whether or not an RG flow has occurred. So this is all I wanted to say today. Thank you very much again for being a good audience. Are there any other questions?
There's no more questions. Thank you.